School starts for most kids in L.A. tomorrow, so it's time to talk about education. By the way, I will say right at the top that I started my work life as a school teacher and taught school, secondary school primarily in the Boston area, and actually founded an alternative high school of which I was the initial director before I headed out to the West Coast. But so this is a subject near and dear to my heart. I have three guests today. The first is Diane Ravitch. As Assistant Secretary of Education under George H.W. Bush, she was Assistant Secretary of Education and a member of the National Assessment Governing Board. That's the entity that oversees education testing. And she was a supporter of that kind of testing, of school choice, of charter schools, of No Child Left Behind, no more. Her new book, The Death and Life of the Great American School System, documents her reversal and the impact she sees of current education policy on communities, schools, families, teachers, and students. And then second, I will bring in Vicky Abeles. Vicky, as a mother, witnessed the pressure young people are under these days to perform, to achieve, to succeed. But it wasn't until her 12-year-old daughter was diagnosed with a stress-induced illness that she finally determined to do something. And her first film, Race to Nowhere, looks at the issue through the eyes of students, teachers, parents, and experts, and challenges us to change things. It opened in Los Angeles and in New York on Friday, September 10th. And then to look at a local school and a new effort to transform education, I'm going to talk with Enrique Gonzalez. He was principal of Frida Kahlo High School, which is the first big-picture school in Los Angeles. And he's working now to transform a large middle school, Nightingale Middle School, to the same model of personalized education that has proven successful in over 60 schools across the country. When I first heard that Big Picture Schools was planning to move into the L.A. Area, I had one of its founders and one of its another member of staff on. This is probably about 2004, and I think it's an exciting model. So I don't want to leave you just in despair with what's wrong. We're going to talk about something which I think is on the path to success. Diane Ravitch is research professor of education at New York University. She, as I said, is Assistant Secretary of Education and counselor to Secretary of Education Lamar Alexander in the administration of George H.W. Bush. She led the federal effort to promote the creation of voluntary state and national academic standards. She was a member of the National Assessment Governing Board, which oversees the National Assessment of Educational Progress, the federal testing program, during the administrations of Bill Clinton and the second George Bush. She's author or editor of 24 books, including The Language Police, How Pressure Groups Restrict What Students Learn, Left Back, A Century of Battles Over School Reform, and her most recent, Death and Life of the Great American School System, How Testing and Choice Are Undermining Education. She blogs at Education Week, that's edweek.org, politico.com, and at the Huffington Post. And you can learn more about her work. And she really does a good job of getting a lot of information up on her website, dianeravitch.com. That's Diane, R-A-V-I-T-C-H, dianeravitch.com. Welcome, Diane Ravitch.
Hi, it's great to be with you.
Thank you very much. I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about. And I think it's significant when someone's change of thinking actually makes news. In other words, there's enough people whose change of thinking everyone ignores. But what I want people to do is, rather than starting by talking about the new book, when you look back, what sort of turning points that you took 20 or 30 years ago led to that position? So it's both, how did you, what's been your path toward the prominence where what you say matters? And then we can talk about the path of how you've looked at education, education reform, and so on.
Right. Well, the first thing you have to know about me is that I'm a historian of education, and most of my books are histories of education. The first book I ever wrote, which was, 35 years ago, was a history of the New York City public school system. And then I've written a history of the 20th century and a history of the schools after World War II, things like that. So I developed a very strong interest in how do we make education better? Why are we constantly going around and around and we keep reforming the schools? I mean, we've been reforming the schools now for well over a century. And I would say right now that the reform wave is probably as strong as it's ever been, and I happen to think most of the ideas are bad ideas. But what led me to support things like choice and accountability was I thought, well, what we're doing isn't working. Let's try something very different. Maybe competition will work. Maybe putting pressure on teachers and kids to have higher performance, maybe that'll work. Maybe charter schools will work. Maybe privatization will work. I guess that I just reached a point of feeling, let's just try it. That, I think, is, in retrospect, I can understand why I got there, but what happened was I can't stop being a historian, which means you look at the evidence.
Yeah.
As I saw the evidence accumulating over these past 5 years, I began to think, whoa, these ideas sounded good, but they're not working. There are some very, very good charter schools. There's some excellent charter schools, but there are more bad charter schools than there are good ones. And I saw the negative effects of accountability, and I know that Vicki Abeles will be talking about that more when she talks about her movie. But I saw states cheating, districts cheating, principals cheating, massive cheating scandals. I saw the curriculum being narrowed, and the very thing that I cared the most about, which was to have students who understood history and science, literature, who were really involved in the arts and had a chance to learn to play an instrument, all of that was being thrown aside because in this current accountability mode, which we've been now in now for at least since No Child Left Behind was passed in 2001 and 2002, the only thing that matters now are reading and math test scores.
Yeah.
And so if the only thing that matters, now it's getting even worse because under the Obama administration, the test scores will be even more punitive than they were under the Bush administration.
Yeah, yeah. I know that, as in so many areas, actually, there's been... you know, we've been disappointed in the ways in which Barack Obama has carried on the errors of George Bush. Let me read one reaction. This is Arthur Levine, former president of Teacher College, where you got your doctorate and began your teaching career. He says, she has done, speaking of you, more than anyone I can think of in America to drive home the message of accountability and charters and testing. Now for her to suddenly conclude that she's been all wrong is extraordinary and not very helpful. Your answer.
Well, I thought when I saw that comment, I thought, what a weird comment. Would he feel better if I were still advocating for choice and charters and accountability?
Yeah, would that be helpful to whom?
I don't know. It was a weird statement. And the only thing I could think of was that I was profiled in 2003 or 4 by the New York Times, and they got a negative statement from Arthur Levine.
Ah.
Back to Arthur Levine again to get a negative.
Oh, okay. So he's a reliable source.
Yeah, it's a reliable source. But we were never at Teachers College at the same time. I was at Teachers College for 20 years, and I left to go into the first Bush administration, and Arthur came in later. So he seems to have some animus towards me.
Okay, we'll let that go. Now, one thing that I found interesting was you say that in 2005 that a study you undertook of Pakistan's education system helped you begin to reconsider or helped in your reconsideration of the things that you had been advocating in the U.S. system.
Right, right. Well, I was asked, I was following what was happening in New York City, and I was really, frankly, very discouraged about the strong emphasis on accountability and choice and the way that neighborhood schools were being closed and et cetera. So when I was invited by a Pakistani non-governmental organization at the U.N., to do a study of standards in Pakistan, my first reaction was, I don't know anything about it, and I told them so. And they said, no, you know, inform yourself and give us a report. And as I did the study of Pakistani education, and it took several months, what I came to realize was that they didn't have a public education system. What they called a public system was so under-resourced, and there was so much teacher absenteeism and student absenteeism, and girls were afraid to go to school because it was just a cultural norm that was not right for them. And most of the kids seemed to be going to madrasas. And I thought, you know what they really need is a strong public school system. It's one of those things where sometimes it helps to step away from the things you're most engaged in.
Yep.
And to see it from a totally different perspective. And that's what happened was that as I looked at this country and another part of the world, I realized that they were pouring so much money into armaments and so little money into creating a reliable public system that this was one of their national problems.
And you could see, I mean, it's interesting when I see the title of the book that came after that, which is The Death and Life of the Great American School System. You looked at Pakistan and said they don't really have one, and you looked here and said, and we're losing ours.
No, well, I'm afraid. I mean,
yeah.
I have never been more concerned for the future of public education than I am today.
Right, and I would say if you do not have successful public education, and by successful I mean an education that educates people, not that scores high on tests, I think you have to fear for democracy.
Well, exactly right, and I think it's not, in this case, just is it charters or not charters, but there is a narrative going on around charters. And again, I will be the first to admit there were some excellent charters, but the narrative is being driven by Wall Street hedge fund people.
What I'd like to do right now for the next few minutes, if you will, is give you five different things that are big parts of all of this. Accountability, standardized testing, merit pay, charters, and privatization, okay? And ask you the good and the bad news and the unintended consequences of each. So accountability.
Okay, with accountability, you're really talking at the same time about standardized testing.
They basically are the same thing.
Right. Accountability is the consequences that follow test scores. So you start by giving kids tests, and everybody says the tests we're using are not very good tests. But mainly what's happening is a lot of people put trust in these tests, and they say if your scores aren't good, your school's not good, are the students doing a terrible job, or the teacher's doing a terrible job. But anybody who looks closely at the testing will say that the test scores themselves are a problem because the tests are not that good. So Arne Duncan just gave out a couple hundred million dollars to develop new tests. But in the meanwhile, he's telling the districts and the states, judge teachers on the basis of these tests that I don't think are very good. So I make a distinction between testing and accountability. I think that there's some value in having testing, but where it gets to be very dicey and I think dangerous is taking those test scores and treating them as though they're a yardstick or a barometer or a thermometer when they're not, and using them to punish kids, punish teachers, punish schools, close schools, fire teachers, and that's called accountability. When people say, how are we going to hold teachers accountable, what they really mean these days is, how are we going to punish
them? That's right.
And I think it's wrong. It's just wrong because the schools that have the lowest scores have the highest poverty. The cities that have the lowest scores have the highest poverty. And this administration is making an erroneous assumption that if your scores are low, you have bad teachers, so fire teachers. And that's just plain wrong. And, we'll talk more about what it does to kids when we talk about Vicky Sohn. But what it's doing now to teachers is to demoralize them, and what it's doing to the schools, we're going to see hundreds of schools close down and replaced by schools that get the same kids with the same problems, and it's all based on tests that are not intended for this purpose.
Yeah, and my guess is that most listeners, unless perhaps they're parents or teachers or follow this really closely, what you just said, we're going to see how many? Thousands? In the country?
Duncan has said he wants 5,000 schools across America. Now, that's about...
Closed.
Yeah, either closed or turned into charters or handed over to private management or the principal fired or the teachers fired or half the teachers fired. I mean, you'll notice that in all of these things that I've just listed, every one of them is a punishment.
That's right.
There's nothing there. There's no strategy that says if the school is doing has low test scores, let's go in and find out why. Let's go in and bring in more teachers to help kids learn to speak English. Let's bring in more resources so that kids can learn to read better. Let's have more arts programs because that inspires kids to come to school and enjoy school. Nothing in the agenda is positive. It's all about how to punish and close and fire or how to hand out merit pays and get teachers to compete with each other. And you would think that if merit pay was such a great idea, teachers would love it. Teachers hate the idea of merit pay.
Why?
Because they know that it destroys the culture of the school. What you want to do in a school is have people who work together, where teachers sit around the table and talk about kids that they're teaching and say, how are we going to help this child? What do we need? Do you have a better idea than I do? And instead, merit pay says, I'm against you, you're against me, all against all, and it destroys the culture and the collaboration.
And it also, if I'm not mistaken, educate me on this. Accountability, and as you say, accountability basically means take tests, improve on tests, or face punishment. Is merit pay going to be based on tests as well, or does that vary by the school or the system?
Oh, yeah, no. This is the nature of accountability. Accountability means consequences, and that means rewards or punishments. So merit pay is part of accountability, And closing schools is part of accountability, and firing teachers is part of accountability. It's all about rewards and sanctions.
But, I mean, what I'm saying is merit pay also based on these tests, which means that, in fact, not only do you lose the sense of collaboration and cooperation about the children's lives rather than the test scores and your own pay, but you also are defining success by these standardized tests.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Merit pay is always based heavily on test scores, and it's identifying the teachers who get the highest test scores. And you probably know that in Los Angeles, they recently had a big...
That was going to be my next question, your response to what's just happened in the LA Times.
The LA Times, put out a list of 6,000 teachers and their test scores. I thought it was disgraceful. And they called me, and I said, exactly, that was disgraceful. And they gave photographs of people and names of people and said, here's a teacher who thought that she was a good teacher, but she's really ineffective because her test scores are low. And that's disgraceful because the leading testing experts in America say that this is wrong, that the tests were not intended for this purpose, that someone who's rated highly effective one year may be ineffective the next year because the test scores will vary depending on who's in the class, and kids are not randomly distributed. And if you have a really terrific class, you'll get high test scores this year. If you teach very challenging kids, then you may not get the test score gains. And teachers, in fact, will then be encouraged not even to teach in the high-need schools.
Right.
So it has a really warping effect. There are all kinds of perverse consequences because if you're going to hand out merit pay based on reading and math scores, why teach the arts? Why teach history? Why teach geography or foreign languages or science or civics? All those things are unimportant when you're pay is and your merit pay is based solely on test scores and reading and math.
Now, the LA Times defended what they did by saying they didn't say this should be the only definer of whether someone is effective, and they, lots of caveats. Yeah. Like when we say ineffective or effective, we say
did they make any other information available about these teachers?
Right.
No. All they gave out was test scores.
Right.
I mean, that was the great fraud in what they did. Which is, they said, we believe in multiple measures, but they only printed one measure. And that's the real danger. And when I first talked to them, I was of the view of, this should be one among many measures. But bottom line is, when you have one measure that's numbers, and the others are qualitative judgments by the principal, by the peers, by the quality of student work, by attendance, the only number that appears is gets in print is the test scores, and they drive everything else.
Right. And as
people, people will give them much more credibility because it's a number.
Yeah. What I was going to say is, there's that famous nostrum from management that, what matters is what counts.
Right.
And if you can't count it, if you can't put a number on it, then it's tough to manage, tough to do all of those sorts of things. And qualitative measures just don't show up the same. So no matter what their caveats, by doing it, in other words, one thing they could have done was they could have done an article that didn't focus on 6,000 teachers but focused on 10. And they could have said, here's their scores, and then we interviewed them, their students, and so on and so on, and made an in-depth article that actually looked at what's the truth behind tests that go up or down versus what's the score.
Well, they also could have looked at the research, and they claim to have interviewed a lot of the researchers, but I know that the researchers that they claim to have interviewed are all opposed to what they did.
Oh, my gosh. You make a distinction between two different tests, and you actually gauge scores on one against the... You talk also about the NAEP. Can you talk about the distinction, just so people are a little more educated on that?
Sure. There's the test given by the federal government, and it's called the National Assessment of Educational Progress, and it's known as NAEP. I was on the board of NAEP for 7 years. After I had served in the Bush administration, I was appointed by President Clinton to serve two terms. So I had a good immersion in the national testing. National tests are given every 2 years in reading and math. Periodically, they will also test history and civics and other subjects, science. And it's called the nation's report card. And the reason that I put a lot of credibility in the NAEP scores is because they have no stakes attached to them. Nobody knows who takes them. Nobody knows who's going to take them next year. Teachers can't prep kids for them. And so it's a gauge, it's a measure that I find trustworthy, mainly because there are no stakes. Now, the reason the state tests are not trustworthy is because there are stakes attached to them. They're given to every child, and teachers know that they will be viewed positively or negatively depending on the student test scores. And so there's a lot of pressure to get the scores up. And so now millions, if not billions, are spent on test prep materials. And there are many districts where kids actually can't read or write or do math, but they've learned how to take tests. And they're getting test prep and test prep and test prep. They will graduate high school, go to a community college where they find that they can't even pass they can't even pass the exam for placement, and they have to go into a remedial course in the very subjects that they've been prepped in for the previous 8 or 12 years. So it's really an immense fraud that's being perpetrated on the American public, because so many kids, like I think it's 50% of the kids entering Cal State University need remediation.
And let me read a couple of quotes. By demanding all students reach proficiency by 2014, the No Child Left Behind incentivized states, districts, and schools to cheat and game the system. That is the direct outcome of high-stakes testing. And as you said, there are no stakes. There are stakes on some, stakes on the other. There are not stakes on the students nearly as directly as there are on the teachers in the schools. So you have these administrations incentivized to get scores whatever way possible. And then in Texas, there was supposed to have been an educational miracle, and that's what right. sort of gave George Bush much of his credibility, was that miracle. Eighth grade reading scores have been flat for a decade. Tennessee claimed that 90% of its students were proficient in 2007, but on the NAEP, only 26% were. So 90% on whatever that standardized test they were using for the consequences, and only 26% on the NAEP. Despite the time and money invested in testing, scores on NAEP have increased slowly or not at all. In mathematics, the rate of improvement was greater before No Child Left Behind was passed. In reading, there have been gains in fourth grade, but the national scores for eighth graders were essentially the same in 2009 as they were in 1998.
Yep, it's really a sad picture, because so much has been invested, and I think that one of the reasons that teachers are very discouraged, and I, over the past 6 months, I'd say I've talked to about 30,000 teachers, because I've been traveling the country on a lecture tour. Teachers are demoralized because when they voted for Barack Obama, they thought he really meant it when he talked about change.
Mm-hmm.
They desperately wanted change in this high-stakes testing that No Child Left Behind has subjected them to. I have yet to meet a teacher who said to me, you know, my school has really benefited, and kids are doing better because of high-stakes testing and No Child Left Behind. I have not met one. And, in fact, the public gets it, because on the latest poll that came out of Gallup poll, there was less than one out of four people who say that they think that the law has done any good.
Okay, so let's talk about charters, and let me just read a couple of quotes you have about charters. What was but an idea in the late 1980s is a full-blown movement today, with 1.5 million students enrolled in 5,000 charter schools. Charter schools receive public money but are privately managed. Unlike regular public schools, they operate free of most rules and regulations. Now, there are variations across this field. Anytime you have 5,000 schools, there's a lot of differences, but more than 95% of charter schools are non-union. The only major national evaluation of the charter school sector was carried out by Margaret Raymond at Stanford, and she found only 17% of charters outperformed a matched public school. The other 80% were no better, or they were worse. So you were pro-charter. You now question charter. Talk about charters. Again, good news, bad news, unintended consequences.
Okay. The original idea behind charters was that charters were going to seek out the neediest kids. They were going to seek out the kids who were dropouts, the kids who were about to drop out, the kids who were disengaged, and that was 1988. Today, and anything you say about charters are going to be exceptions. There are schools that still do that, but they're a small minority. Because of the high-stakes regime under which American education is living, charters are now incentivized to avoid the lowest-performing kids, to go into the poorest community and to skim off the highest-performing kids in the poorest communities. And so, for instance, they have disproportionately small numbers of kids who are English language learners, disproportionately small numbers of kids who are special education, and then they compare themselves to the neighborhood public school, which has disproportionately larger numbers of the same groups, and they say, look, we're beating you, we're better than you are. And what's happened to make the narrative even more interesting, if not frightening, is that Wall Street hedge fund managers have made charter schools their favorite cause. There have been two front-page articles in the New York Times about the three front-page articles about the number of billionaire hedge fund managers who've decided that charter schools and privatization is what they most want to advance. And I find that frightening, because they have no commitment to public education, and they think that you know, this is going to help American society. The more they can privatize and the more they can skim in the poorest communities, and it will lead to a two-track system of 50 or 60% of kids in charters, which is the case in New Orleans.
Which all of that, very much of that happened after Katrina. Katrina,
right.
as people will say, never miss a chance to take advantage of a crisis.
Right.
And that's one of the things that has happened. So Katrina now is this test case of privatization and charters, isn't it? I mean, not Katrina, but New Orleans.
Well, New Orleans is, the privatizers love to point to New Orleans because they wiped out the union, they wiped out the public education system. It's been replaced with schools that are now where the 60% of the kids are in charters. They don't want to expand beyond 60% because nobody wants the other 40%. They're the losers. They're the rejects. They're the kids that nobody wants. And, of course, the high-stakes testing is everybody's definition of what a good school is. And they've created a two-track system and eliminated public education. You may recall that Secretary Duncan said that Katrina was the best thing that ever happened to education in New Orleans. But if this is what's going to happen to education in America, we'll have no public system. We'll have a lot of privatizers running the schools. And we'll have the kids, the 40% of kids that no one wants will be in a desperate situation.
Okay. And finally, another quote from you. You say, why members of Congress and Washington think tanks continue to defend this toxic law, and this was No Child Left Behind or the new race to the top and so on. And may I offer two possible answers?
Sure.
One, politicians prefer simple slogans and solutions. And two, follow the money.
I think that follow the money is really critical because there's this group called Democrats for Education Reform. It's composed mainly, again, of these billionaire hedge fund managers. They're pumping money into state legislative races all over the country to promote the privatization agenda, and that's scary. And I've met with congressmen and senators, and mostly they don't pay that much attention to education. It's just, if this is what the president wants, that's what he gets. Arne Duncan actually had the same policies in Chicago that he's now promoting for the nation. Closed schools, open charter schools. All the studies that I've seen say that it's made no difference in the achievement. The current issue of Catalyst magazine, which does research on Chicago schools and reports on them, said that where they are today, 8 years after Arne Duncan started, was mediocre test scores, high turnover of teachers, very unstable charter schools with shaky budgets. And it's really it's no model, but it's the model, in fact, that we're being given for the nation.
Right. And just one last thing about charters. Again, I'm going to quote you. In Harlem, which is a heavy concentration of charters, the regular public schools must market themselves to students and families. In other words, you've got to sort of go, no, come to our school or come to theirs. Public schools typically have a budget of about $500 for flyers and brochures, and the aggressive charter chain that competes with them has a marketing budget, according to the New York Times, of $325,000.
Yeah.
And so when we come down to that, I mean, I know one last question I want to ask you before we switch over, and I'm going to bring in Vicki Abeles, how we had this big fight about health care, and health care is 17% of GDP. How big is do you know what the portion of GDP education is?
I have no idea.
Okay. But I would think that that healthcare and education are probably the two biggest businesses in America because every kid goes to school. And to see what's happened to healthcare begin to happen to education.
Right.
Where the public schools are driven down, as you say, to a 60-40 split where they've got the 40 that the charters and the privatization doesn't want. It's shameful, and people have to start paying attention.
Well, you should know that a number of the charter companies are called EMOs, modeled on HMOs. And, they have marketing operations and central office operations, and their business model depends on a very high turnover of teachers because they work their teachers 50, 60, 70 hours a week, and people don't stay long enough to collect pensions or retirement benefits.
By the way, that's the same method in the fast food industry, which I remember when I interviewed Eric Schlosser about Fast Food Nation.
Yeah, well, it also connects with Teacher America, and I think Teacher America is a very lovely program in its way. I probably would have joined it if I was right out of college, but Teacher America signs on for 2 years. They're the people who they get a full teacher's salary, and then within 2 to 3 years, they're gone, And it's that kind of turnover that's very, I think it's very damaging to schools. What you need in a school is a stable community of experience and effective teachers, not a constant influx of young people.
Right, that old tradition where you'd show up in school and the teacher, because it happened to me, would say, oh, you're your older sister's brother, you know, and then the four others that came after me, it was, oh, you're their little brother. And it was true that people yeah. even were taught mother and child by the same teacher.
Right. Well, I was one of eight children, so I didn't really want to follow my older brother or sister, and the ones who came after me had a lot of trouble. I understand that.
No, okay.
But it's about having a community. It's about having a place where there's people share problems and they solve problems together, and they're part of a community, and there's stability. We have enough instability and mobility and chaos in our daily lives so that we should be building institutions and not just closing them down and destroying them.
Right. Okay, Vicki Abeles is the founder of Real Link Films and producer-director of Race to Nowhere. It's her first feature documentary. Previously, she worked as a corporate attorney. She also facilitates the parents group on Edutopia, part of the George Lucas Educational Foundation. Welcome, Vicki Abeles.
Thank you. Thank you for having me this morning.
Okay, I like listeners to get a feel for the people. As I said with Diane, Race to Nowhere is your first film. Why did you decide to make it?
Well, Terrence, this started in my own home several years ago. I've got three children, and my daughter, who was then 12 at the time and in seventh grade, became physically sick from the pressure she was feeling at school. Around that same time, what I was seeing in her was a student who had become disengaged from school. She was in sixth grade, was no longer excited about going to school. And I was seeing a quantity-driven model at her school, very test-oriented. She was sleep-deprived, and importantly, she was sick. I felt frustrated and alone as a parent, and I started to speak to other parents and students and educators in all kinds of communities. And what I learned was that kids everywhere were becoming anxious and depressed. So many of them were sleep deprived, and many had even checked out. As I started talking to college professors and employers, I started hearing about a generation of young people who are arriving in college and in the workplace unprepared and uninspired. And so I started to speak with educators, parents, and students from across the country, from suburban communities to the inner city, and knew this was an important story to tell, and importantly wanted to create something that would bring people together, that would bring communities together and inspire change. And so I decided to give voice to the students and teachers through this documentary, Race to Nowhere.
Okay, and Race to Nowhere, as I said, opened in New York and Los Angeles this past Friday. It is playing in Los Angeles this week. I'm not sure of which theater. I think it's maybe at the Sunset 5. But you can certainly find out more about it at Race to Nowhere, one word, racetonowhere.com. But for people who won't catch it in theaters, I notice there's screenings all over the country. And if someone wants to get involved with this issue, they can do so by going to racetonowhere.com.
Absolutely. And so this isn't just a film. This film is a vehicle for bringing communities together and inspiring a grassroots movement with the film at the center. Anyone can organize a screening. And what we've done is selected four dates this fall where we're going to be screening the film in hundreds, if not thousands, of communities nationwide and, in fact, even overseas. And then there will be a dialogue at all of these screenings following the film. So right now we've got several hundred scheduled in the next 2 months, in addition to the theatrical run this week in L.A. and New York.
So even in Los Angeles, there will be some of these screenings?
Absolutely.
Very good.
And so what we're doing is we're asking parents and educators who want to bring the film and the dialogue to their community to contact us to find a venue, whether it's a school, a local theater, a community center, and we will take care of the rest. And interestingly, we're actually offering these screenings as fundraisers for schools that provide venues.
Very good.
So there's another incentive to bring this in. We're finding tremendous support amongst educators and parents who want to come together and start creating a new vision for education.
Okay, so what we talked about here was the stress, the fact that the kids let's say it focuses primarily on high school kids, but obviously the problems start sooner, but I think it focuses primarily on high school kids. And what you see in the film, by the way, let me just tell people, is you see a lot of students speaking directly to Vicki, to the camera, telling you what this is like in their life, parents, teachers, and people who are trying to deal with this problem. But what we have is an achievement track, a success track, a test-oriented track that leads them to study for these tests, to take AP courses, to do enormous amounts of homework. And it seems like, again, we've got something here that there's a positive motivation here, but something's gone wrong. What's gone wrong?
Well, I think that our film shows that our current education system, our test-driven performance and competitive model isn't working for any kids, and they're doing things for extrinsic reasons, whether it's to get the test scores for their schools or to get into college. And so I think we're just putting tremendous pressure on their backs, really driven by a great deal of fear on the part of the adults, fear that our country is falling behind. And so we've created a very narrow vision for what it means to be a successful young person. And so much of what's happening in our schools is just driven to preparation for a test. So we've narrowed the kids' experience, and our schools have become test prep centers. And whether we're talking about our inner city schools where the test prep is for these standardized tests, or in our suburban schools, the college track children who are preparing for the AP test, I think it's a very narrow way. It's not feeling relevant to the kids. It's not engaging. And I also think it's become a real quantity-driven model. And so you have kids who are staying up until 1 and 2 in the morning to do work and then to go back and do the same thing the next day.
You mentioned that this problem bleeds into throughout the school system, because when I first thought about this film, I thought, is this just a problem of the affluent?
Right.
And your sense is that let me see if I've got it right, that on one hand, for those in inner city schools or non-affluent school systems who aspire to college, they will have to compete just even harder than the kids in the suburban school systems, because they start out sort of at a disadvantage. And then even those who aren't necessarily competing with the suburban school systems, they're competing just because standardized testing is now becoming what is now replacing education, if you will.
Well, I don't even think it's not even necessarily the competing in the latter case, Terrence. I think that what you have is just kind of a mind-numbing experience for these students. So in our inner city schools, we hear from Emma in our film, who talks about how, you know, the entire day is oriented towards preparing for tests in reading and math. And I think that, you know, it's understandable then why the students stop showing up, right? And for those who are college-bound in those schools, I think they face the same pressures that we're seeing in our suburban communities, with the additional pressures that they have a lot less resources to work with.
Right, and perhaps the stakes of an entire family on their young shoulders. Are you saying, and I think this is a crucial point, that not only are the kids being stressed and hurt by the pressures, but that they're not being well-educated or prepared?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I think that is the overriding issue here, is that ultimately we're not preparing this next generation to be contributing members of society. No matter what your path, whether it's college or the workplace, we are not preparing young people. And so I think that, you know, that it's critical. That's an epidemic that we're not preparing them. And then the health issues are also epidemic. And so we spend a lot of time in the film, as you know, Terrence, hearing from students who have become sick or depressed.
Yeah, yeah.
Or they're abusing performance medications. But we also hear from students who have literally checked out because of the way that school is structured today. And I would say that that's a majority of the students that we spoke to. And so what we see is that this isn't working for anyone.
Okay, before I bring in Enrique Gonzalez, who's working with Big Picture Schools in L.A., which my sense tells me tries to answer some of the problems we've talked about, both with Diana, with Vicky. Again, you can learn more, you can get involved at racetonowhere.com. What are some of the solutions, very briefly, Vicky?
So, well, I think the first solution is you have to see the film to really understand the breadth of the issues, to hear from the experts, from leading education experts and child development experts across the country. And what we're really trying to do is to shift the paradigm and to empower everyone to start making changes at the local level, in their schools, in their homes, and put what works for kids front and center. You know, big picture things, we have to do so much better in terms of valuing our teachers as professionals, compensating them as professionals. But we're dealing with a situation here where layers of change are needed, and we need to start involving all stakeholders in shaping the vision for the future.
Okay, very good. That's the voice of Vicki Abeles. She is the producer-director of Race to Nowhere, the documentary on the pressure and competition that teens face these days. It's playing this week in Los Angeles and New York, but as you hear, this is something worth seeing, worth getting involved in, and you can do that by going to racetonowhere.com. About 100 years ago, John Dewey, the educational leader of his time, said that school should be the work of real life, not practicing for real life. And then Catherine Graham, the extraordinary leader of the Washington Post, said work should be full of learning and fun. And big picture schools attempt to embody both of those concepts. I've read a wonderful book about the first of these schools, the Met School in Providence, Rhode Island. The book is called A Kid at a Time by Elliot Levine. Enrique Gonzalez works with big picture schools. He was principal of its first school in L.A. He's now working to bring that model to the Nightingale Middle School, which will be interesting because when I read One Kid at a Time, it seemed that the model worked best for high schools, and so I'm intrigued by how they're going to bring the same model to Nightingale Middle School. And so I want to welcome Enrique Gonzalez to Pacifica and Free Forum. Enrique? First of all, just for folks, how long have you been an educator, and how did you get involved with big picture schools?
I guess long enough to be considered an old man at school.
How many? How 24?
First of all, I want to make clear that I work for the Los Angeles Unified School District, and there's a lot of people that are embarrassed to say that to some degree, and I'm very proud of it because I think what we're doing is cutting-edge stuff, and it's happening in a lot of parts of the city. Big picture came into view as a result of being suspended in elementary school and sent to the library to sit amongst the books as an elementary school student, and caught with nothing to do, I read all the biographies of our great leaders, Jefferson, Washington, Lincoln, etc. Well, long story short, all the way to Vietnam, come home, go to college. People looked at me like I was crazy. Why would you want to go to college? I had a 1.7 GPA in high school. But I knew that there was something lacking, and I chased it. Excuse me, I'm a little bit hoarse. And what it has been, this voyage in education, led me to Elliot Washer and Dennis Lipke and their work, because I had realized that the only way we're going to solve the educational equation, if you will, that has been described so beautifully by Diane and by Vicki, is to look at student interest and the engagement of students, the personalization of kids. And so Big Picture was doing that. So I chased Elliot for about 3 years. Very difficult because what had happened, there was some disturbances at Jefferson High School, excuse me, that we all know about. And it opened an opportunity with Roy Romer to look at schools of choice. So I lobbied with Elliot, would they accept the school in Los Angeles? And to be honest, at the beginning, I don't think they were very enthused about it, but they realized that I wanted and I thought along their line of thinking. I'm a Ted Sizer addict, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And so as a result of that, we were fortunate to get the MOU. And I need to make clear about this assessment piece, the authentic assessments. Well, we're playing the game with API AYP, and it will be announced tomorrow that Frida Kahlo High School has risen 159 points in 3 years. Now, that's a huge jump. Why? Not because so much of anything that one individual did. People like to claim, what would you call it, notoriety for that. But I think it's the big picture model. What it does, in essence, if I may, is it creates a stability within the kids. We have a disengaged, bored youth today in America. We all know that. We can't seem to reach them through the methods we're using. And teaching to the test is definitely not the answer. Ironically, the value-added discussion that took place this last couple weeks in Los Angeles, we take a different slant of value added in big picture. The value we add is what value did we add to the family, to the mother, the father, the family in their home? Did the child, is the child wanting to go to school? Do they want to learn? Has their behaviors at home changed to be more respectful, etc.? So we took that on full bore. Now, how do we do it? We did it by looking, or trying to reach the standards through interest-based education. Well, big picture teaches, and our philosophy is that, we are going to build a school that is driven by that interest and uses internships. In other words, putting a student in an environment that they would choose to learn from. I'll give you an example. A young person says to me, Mr. Gonzalez, I want to work as an auto mechanic. But they're totally disengaged in class. And by the way, the examples I'm giving you are fact. They did, in fact, happen. We put the young kid to look for a mechanic. He found one. And then the kid came back to school and said, Ms. Ketcher, his math teacher, I do need to know about this fraction stuff and this equation stuff. It drove him back to the textbook. Today, the worst thing we can do is put a textbook in front of a young person, because what happens is they shut off immediately. Whereas if we find the interest that they like, for example, another student. You know, I go to my dentist a lot, and I'm fascinated by it. Kid wasn't performing, was doing abusing drugs, things like that. We got him involved with a dentist. Next thing you know, his grades are straight. things are clicking because he's so excited about learning the chemistry, the biology, the math, the English structures, everything, ELA, all the things we want kids to do, because of the interest of becoming a dentist possibly. So what we've done is we've put kids together. In its very basic form, we've sent 20 to 30 kids every year to the middle schools around, or elementary schools around Frida Kahlo High, which is in the Santee Education Complex, to serve as interns to see if they wanted to become teachers. And the success, again, with those kids is astounding.
Now, wait a minute. Do you mean to become teachers by not in their adult life, but to tutor nowadays?
To tutor today to become a teacher tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
See, we're chasing that sophist mentality, the lover of learning. How do you get a kid that's in an urban setting, and all big-picture schools are, and get them to see that there is that hope that they can become what their dream says they want to be through their interest? And that's critical. I don't think we do a good job of that because, you know, like I know, and so does Diane and everybody, that our kids today will have to unlearn and relearn repeatedly in this next generation because we don't even know the jobs they're going to have. I find it ironic and beautiful that kids will run to a Twilight film release and at a movie house, and they'll read those books like crazy. But you give them, Hemingway or Steinbeck or any of those folks, and they're a little more lethargic. Well, that interest, we have to drive it through finding out what the kid, you know, always running. A book by Lou Rodriguez is so inspirational to kids, and seeing to some is a negative thing. But the fact that kids begin to read, a 37% increase in ELA proficiency, even though, again, I hate to go towards that test, is testament to these kids wanting to. So what we did, we created an environment where the kids in the community owned the school by using every way we could. For example, plants, gardening, music, a heavy dose of guitar work, the Son Jarocho. Cesar Castro has been on your show in the past. And these were all volunteer people that came to join into the Frida Kahlo experience, if you will. And I would throw a plug for folks. And, again, it's not self-serving. It's not about me. Go to fkhs.org and look at the website and see what has happened. There's a lot of things on that website that folks can look at to help that conversation along. Particularly the latest edition, which is mobile learning with the Pearson Education Group out of San Francisco, where young people, imagine in the old days, they used to tell you, get on a bus, you're going to teach in this community. We want to take you around your neighborhood to look at the neighborhood to see the kind of kids and stuff that you're going to work with. Well, the kids are producing those items. It's on the website, and you can see. So when our teachers were able to physically see and visit, if you will, a home, even though it was through media, right, filming, they created a bond, an empathy, because in a real core, if you will, diagram, three circles all intertwined. One is curriculum and instruction. We want kids to go to that. We want them to realize that. Two is structure, a safe school, that environment. And the three, the huge piece for me, is personalization, that every adult on a campus should know the name of every child on a campus. Well, you put those three together, and what do you get? You get improved student achievement. And it's not just API, AYP. It's about their personalities, how they become respectful. We didn't have to worry about a janitor to this day at Frida Kahlo because the kids would pick up the trash after lunch. Now, you just consider that point right there.
Wow.
In the very least, in American schools, we spend thousands, probably millions of dollars on support to clean campuses. No graffiti on the campus, five-year-old campus to date. Now, next door, unfortunately, the Santee Education Complex has a problem with graffiti. So what I had advocated some time back to Ramon Cortinez and Roberto Martinez and my superiors was, let's see what we can do in a bigger setting. And so I have been promoted to Nightingale Middle School, a wonderful middle school, 1,400 kids, right there by Dodger Stadium, with the intent of taking philosophically these concepts to that opportunity and trying to drive that way. And I think we'll be very successful.
Okay, I've got to cut you off, Enrique, because the hour is running out. Enrique Gonzalez is working with Big Picture Schools. You can learn more at bigpicture.org and fkhs.org. FK is Frida Kahlo. HS is high school. FKHS. And you can also look at that book, A Kid at a Time by Elliot Levine, which really tells the story of the first big picture school. Diane Ravitch's book is Death and Life of the Great American School System. Her website is dianeravitch.com. Vicki Abele's movie is Race to Nowhere, and their website is racetonowhere.com. And I think what you can find from all of these is that we got problems, but there are solutions, and it takes us getting involved. You can go to all of those websites to get involved. Thank you all, and keep up your good work.
Thanks.